Welcome to Toy Power. This is the podcast where we talk toys and everything pop culture. I'm Trent, and I'm also the terror that flaps in the night. And we're here with Frank, Darren and Ben. Gentlemen, welcome to Toy Power.
Yeah, g'day guys. This is Frank, and I just have one question to ask. Where does he get those wonderful toys? I thought that was kind of appropriate.
That was very cool.
Very cool. And I just like to say, yeehaw!
It's Cowboy Darren joining us today.
That was my Jukes of Hazzard.
Nice. Oh, Ben's thinking.
Yeah, I'll be back.
Oh, you're still thinking?
Okay. Yeah.
Was that a Terminator or a Skeletor quote?
Nah, oh, a bit of both, I suppose.
Good call.
Nice, I like that. Well, we tried it. It might not always work, but we give it a go. Today we've got a podcast really centered around a look at Wonder Woman, because that film's been out for a couple of weeks now, probably into about a month, and it's doing very well at the box office. I think in terms of a female director helming a big blockbuster film, Patty Jenkins is now in the number one spot.
Just as any film. Any film directed by a female.
Any film directed by a female now in the number one spot.
So getting close to $650 million. And I think the projections are we'll get there this weekend. So that's really exciting. All the reviews I've heard from people I've gone and seen it with has been really positive. So that's great. So we just wanted to have a bit of a chat today about Wonder Woman and our thoughts. We'll do a quick toy line retrospective. So a bit of a 2-minute pitch. So I think Ben, Darren and myself will go through a couple of more obscure toy lines. And then we'll just finish with our latest scores of what we've been able to pick up. So we'll kick off with Wonder Woman. So we got teased Wonder Woman in the Batman versus Superman film. And to many people, the appearance of Wonder Woman in that film was a highlight. And people said, you know, she stole the show, or she was a really good appearance. And the way they did her in that film was really nice. So I think everyone was pretty excited when Wonder Woman got her green-lit solo film. And really to see a female in a title role and really driving a big budget modern iteration of a superhero film was great to see. So all of us have now gone and checked it out, and I thought we'd sort of go around the room and get our thoughts on the film. So, so what did you guys think?
Just to clarify for everyone, we're going to keep this spoiler-free, so if you haven't seen the film, don't worry. We'll convince you to go see it. So... I might start then. My wife, as much as she's into, like, she'll go with me to see the latest Marvel whatever and Star Wars and stuff, she was terrifically excited by this movie. We went to Gold Class, so we did the proper Silver Service and all that sort of stuff. And look, it was just... And I've heard she was a little bit the same, but I've heard reports of, people go with their wives or partners or whatever, and... I had a friend of mine say, my wife was like boxing when we came out. Like, she had a guard up. She was ready. She was ready to punch me. And I'm like, what did I do wrong? She's like, no, that's just how amped up I am. It's a film that, really has the desired result in making women feel empowered. Not that it should be inciting violence, but, that they're ready to go, which I think was always one of the goals of the movie. And I think from a bloke's point of view, it did that without making blokes seem like second-class citizens. And, it wasn't denigrating to males in the same way that historically a lot of movies have done the other. A lot of male-centric movies have, the women are just a side thing. This was, it was led by a woman, but it didn't really matter. It didn't matter whether you're male or female. You walked out of that cinema going, I feel good about the world, That was probably my main takeaway sort of walking out.
Yeah, look... I absolutely love the film. I've got to say that. I've seen it twice now, and I need to see it again. That's how I feel about it. The interesting thing about Wonder Woman, as we've talked about in other podcasts, is how long it's taken. The character's 75 years of age and sits in a very special club alongside Batman and Superman.
She's looking good for 75 years.
She is looking remarkable, isn't she? But she sits in a very special club with Batman and Superman as characters that have been in print for 75 or more years continuously with no interruption. So it's a very exclusive club. To finally see a film, and I'm not trying to sound negative when I say that, but to finally see a film was sensational. I feel this film did a great job, and I'll try and avoid the spoilers here, but it did a great job of unpacking the character's development that we see in Batman vs. Superman, lot of her motivations in that. And I don't know if anyone else has watched Batman vs. Superman since seeing Wonder Woman, but I've watched the Ultimate Cut a couple of times since then, and you do feel that you understand Diana a lot better, and it gives you a lot of sense. A lot of people said that Batman vs. Superman was too dark, or it was too this. I think this unpacks a lot of why her character is where she's at. Obviously, we knew going into this where Superman was at following Man of Steel. So, you know, we went into Batman vs. Superman knowing that this really unpacks for Diana. It's not just an origin story in that sense, but it also has some scenes that really do tie it to Batman vs. Superman. And I think it does enhance that film greatly. But it stands on its own two feet. You don't need to have seen Batman vs. Superman. In fact, one of the people I went to see it, the second time I went to see it with, she hadn't seen that at all. And, you know, she'd been waiting to see this film for over a year since it was announced. And she's not a comic book movie fan at all. She's, you know, her main stuff is actually the non-studio art house Palace Nova kind of film. She did ask me briefly, you know, is it going to hurt having not seen Batman versus Superman after I'd seen Wonder Woman with Trent and Ben? And I, you know, I said, look, I don't think it will. It enhanced Batman versus Superman for me a lot, but I don't think it's going to diminish your enjoyment of this film. And, you know, she really enjoyed it. And, you know, I'm hearing that a lot of people that are not comic book fans are.
Yep.
It's filled a void in that sense, and that we haven't had a female-driven superhero film in a long, long time. You know, obviously there's Supergirl, Catwoman, Elektra, that sort of thing. But we haven't seen one in a long time. DC beat Marvel on this one. And they didn't just rush it and beat them. It's actually a sensational film.
I've truly enjoyed it. I've seen it twice as well. It's a very powerful film, and I think they chose the environments quite well, in the sense that Wonder Woman she's like, her colour is just brightened so much in the contrasting of the brown and dark era of the war. That's right. So I love that, that brightness of her costume, as opposed to what we've seen in BVS, which is no disrespect to, the original, but some of the fighting scenes are fantastic. Love the early fight scenes at the start of the movie, and the end fight scenes, everything. You could just watch those fight scenes over and over again. Just truly magic, fantastic. When I first saw it, I saw it with my wife, and she loved it as well. And what she took out of it was, she was a bit concerned that Wonder Woman was going to go in with a tiny little skirt on, scantily clad costume, and she'd be a sex symbol. But she was at no point was she, did the camera pan in and zoom in on her breasts or her legs or anything like that. So she was really respectful of that, that the female director has still given, has made Wonder Woman powerful from the get-go, from the word, from the and built her up for the audience to believe that she's of her origin to be powerful and things. Later onwards, and my wife took my daughter of 5 years old to see the movie, so I've actually recorded a little 1 minute review from her eyes. And as you said, Frank, at the end, my wife caught her fisticuffing the screen as the fight scene at the end took place. So she was involved enough that she was
Wonder Woman.
Exactly. So here we are.
Hello, what's your name?
Hello, my name is Scarlett.
And how old are you?
Five.
And what did you see today?
At Wonder Woman.
And did you like it?
Yes.
Did you give it 2 thumbs up?
Yes.
What was your favourite part of Wonder Woman?
The ending part.
And what happened at the end?
She jumped at the... She first gave Batman the picture, then she jumped out the window.
Oh, was that good, was it?
Yeah.
And did you dress up today?
Yes.
Well, who'd you dress up as?
Wonder Woman.
Oh, awesome. Thank you, Scarlett.
You're welcome.
Awesome review, Scarlett, but unfortunately we said no spoilers, and I think that jumping out the window has just ruined it for all our listeners. But no, that's great. Good work.
Thanks.
Yeah, for me, like we said, the parts that were filmed on the Themyscira or the Paradise Island were really quite colourful.
Yeah, and they were great.
That was great because of what then came after it.
With definitely.
Heading to London, and that contrast was quite apparent, and going into No Man's Land and some of those scenes. And I think, you know, eventually the final reveal of when Wonder Woman does come out in the costume so nicely. I think it's one of the best character reveals.
That was the I've movie. That was the point.
Was so iconic. It reminded me of Richard Donner's Superman when Christopher Reeve takes flight in the...
Spot on.
You know, Fortress of Solitude scene.
I rate that as when the X-Men first came together and they walk out all four, the first X-Men movie. I thought that's what reminded me.
Yeah,
very iconic.
The story goes that Patty Jenkins, in discussion, because obviously discussions with Warner Brothers and the studios, they didn't want that scene in the movie. And she went, "You're kidding, right? Like, this is important. I'm not cutting that scene out." And she had to fight really hard for that scene. And now you look back at it and you go, "All right, you take that scene out of the movie. What have you got?
When's a big reveal?"
Exactly. Like, I don't know what. And, you know, again, this is internet hearsay. I'm not sure, you know, how hard she had to fight for it. But, you know, I'm bloody glad she did.
Mm. Look, it wouldn't surprise me when you look at the theatrical cuts for Batman vs. Superman and Suicide Squad.
Yeah,
There is... I know a lot of people think it's double dipping to sell a version later, but I think essentially my conspiracy theory has always been they try and make these films as short as possible to sell to fit in as many sessions per day and sell as many tickets.
Yeah.
And you can lose a quality in the story if you go too far in that direction.
And then they do have an ultimate edition to bring out later on with all the extra scenes.
That's true. That's true, but they lose a lot of respect because people think, well, why isn't it the version you put up? Because it's the stronger version of the two.
Yeah, my understanding is Patty Jenkins has said that is the final cut. There is no extra special edition that will come later on. So, but yeah, look, I thought the Paradise Island stuff was done really nicely, and that feeds into Diana's backstory, and to me it created, you know, we talked in a previous podcast about what is the canon and how will they do it,
the origin film.
To me they just did it perfectly.
Yeah,
there was enough reference to canons that have come in the past, but mystery as well around it that formed part of the plot, which I think, you know, unraveled as we learnt more. So that I think was done really well. I thought, you know, the acting was very good. Robin Wright pops up in there. I just thought that was a really great role, and I think, you know, there may have been some level of criticism, but I think Gal Gadot does a fantastic job.
Yep.
The nuances are really nice with the sort of the fish out of water stuff and a male dominated world that she comes into, and the way she stands up for, I guess, or points out the reality of some of the absurdities that are going on, which I think are really...
She calls it because she's just like, this doesn't make sense and this is why, and you've got Chris Pine's character going, but that's just the way it is, and even he can just sort of see him, he goes, this is pretty dumb.
I can't make sense of it. Which is great. I found, and look, the action sequences, to Ben's points, it's done so beautifully. Yeah. I mean, there's some sequences, I think they've been on the trailer, where she's basically fighting some soldiers and it slows down and it sort of shows the way she's moving, the fluidity, and It's just beautifully choreographed. I think it's, and it, so it, you yep. feel the power, you feel that it yep. feels real.
And they're all different. That's cool. What I liked about it is they're all unique and different. They're not the same. She's not kicking the same way or, you know, doing whatever. They're all very unique and different. So
yeah. Mm. Really good chemistry, I think, between Chris Pine and
Gal Gadot. Absolutely.
Some really great lines, and if there's criticisms for some of the other DC films being dark, this one really does create some really great moments. I was laughing out loud quite often in the cinema.
Yep.
And you know, Chris Pine does it really well. Some of those comedic scenes.
You feel like they had genuine chemistry, not just two people saying, "Oh, say the lines," and make you buy their relationship. Basically,
yeah,
which is great acting.
Yeah, and there's some great. There's a scene on a boat, which I think some of the way, you know, that's they're interacting so in that scene is just beautiful.
When I saw that being set up, I was like, oh, here it comes. He's going to be the cringy bit, and I'm like, do you know what? I enjoyed that scene. Yeah. It was actually really well acted, well written, and yeah, it was really really nice.
And the references to the 12 volumes of a particular book were just very very nicely done. That was good. Look, I did find, you know, in the film there is, I guess, a bit of a team up. So Chris Pine, Wonder Woman do team up, and for those that have seen Batman versus Superman, there's a photo taken, and that sort of brings together the team. I thought one character in that team in particular annoyed me a little bit, in that they were, I guess they were put in for some level of comic relief, but they went a bit too far in the caricature of a particular
the Scottish
guy. Yeah. The Scottish, and I think there were some scenes in there that I think they were trying to make it deeper or broader than what it came across. Without a spoiler, there's a scene where he sort of wakes up at night and he's haunted by ghosts, and then that just doesn't go anywhere.
It felt like a thread waiting to be pulled that just sort of got left hanging.
To me, it felt like, you know, they wanted to build this team philosophy and have this connection with the broader team. I didn't buy it in the end that there was that connection there. So I thought that was maybe a little bit of a misstep. And why they had to have sort of this, you know, to me, this ragtag group of people that are pulled together and ragtag for the sake of being ragtag.
Mm. Well, my question around that was it's World War One, and her that little... I've got no problem with being a group that sort of, you know, rallies around Wonder Woman, and I think that's important, because if it's just Chris Pine, you go, well, they're two people. Don't get me wrong, Wonder Woman is amazing, but they're two people, whereas having a group, then they can go... Then, you know, it's a bit of maybe a poor example, but a Jesus and his disciples type thing, where you go, he had those people, and then those people told their friends, and they told, and that's how the legend sort of spreads, is how I looked at it.
Yeah.
My issue with it is that you're talking World War One, and in the group of five people, you had an American, Chris Pine, who supposedly was working for British intelligence. His accent was never addressed in any way. Like, all it needed was a throwaway line to say he's on loan from the CIA or something like that. There was a Native American Indian, an Egyptian, I think he was, and a Scottish guy, all in the one thing. And you go, aren't they in, like, a joke? They all walk into a bar.
Yeah, exactly. We're in a bar,
And I just went, I don't know why they all had to be... I mean,
I agree. They didn't know. It struck me as a little odd. Why he had a Scottish guy in there? I think, to me, the American Indian was the character. There was a nice parallel. I think where they're all around the campfire and they make some comment around.
Yeah, that was a great line.
That was really nicely done, and I think you needed to have an American Indian in that to give that context. I really liked the Egyptian character. I thought he was done really nicely.
Yep.
I just felt. The Scottish character was a bit out of place and a bit overacted.
That's fair. What did we think of the English secretary lady? And I forget her name.
Loved her scenes. Yeah. She was gold.
She's been in like a few of the Brit, like the Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead. And I think she was the original Dawn from the British Office as well. So she's got that background in comedy and has got the timing and stuff. Yeah.
Really
underused, good. If anything, I would say.
Yeah, no, the scenes were good. They weren't excessive, but they were good.
Mm.
For me, there was a bit of a With the chief protagonist, I guess you'd say. There's two. There's a general in the German army who plays a pretty key role, and I think that's actually a historically accurate character.
Oh, okay.
As I was being told,
I didn't know that.
There was a very, I don't know, I found a very forced scene where they're, how to put this, but they make a joke, the two evil characters at one point.
Yeah.
And I felt that was, it was horribly acted from a physical point of view.
It was overacted.
It was overacted or something. There was something wrong with that one particular scene. But, and I felt sometimes they were going down a little bit of a cardboard cutout villain for the sake of, you've got to give him these elements to make him the villain. Yeah. And there were a few things that felt maybe a bit forced, and they didn't need to. They could have just had a really good character and just played it fairly straight.
Yeah.
And they didn't need to go down that path. But beyond that, they're probably my only criticism.
And I think it's interesting that all the negatives or the things you didn't so much like about the movie, nothing to do with the script overall, nothing to do with your lead characters and stuff. It was all, those are all minor bit parts
that didn't have
a huge impact on things, you know, and I think that speaks to the quality of the writing and the direction, that a couple of the minor characters didn't sit well with you. That's not a make or break thing. You're still going to go back and see it a second time.
Oh, I have already.
Well, there you go.
where does this leave you all now feeling about Wonder Woman's role in the DC Extended Universe? Obviously, we know a sequel is coming, but she's also going to be playing a very central role in Justice League.
I think she's going to put bums on seats at Justice League that weren't going to be there 2 months ago.
Well called.
Yeah, well called.
Plain and simple.
Having said that, I was so excited for that film before this. I even saw this. This just leaves me even more pumped. Look, I think it's gonna, I think you're right. It will bring in people who perhaps even haven't seen Batman versus Superman, but just want to see the continuing arc. And I think this film sets up very well what we're already getting a sense of in the trailers. You know, obviously Diana is very much working with Bruce to set up the League. She's a founding member of the League. But this film, you know, if there was ever any doubt in anyone's mind that Wonder Woman is just as much a hero as Batman, Superman, Aquaman, anyone else in that film or in that universe, then I think that's fine. Those doubts have been one truly sunk. She is just as formidable as any male character, and she's a natural leader. It makes sense that she's a founding member of the League.
I think until, and let's be honest, we all know Superman is going to return at some point in the Justice League.
Oh, you just ruined it for me.
But I think until that happens in the and even after it, she's the muscle. Yeah. When you look at that team that they're assembling, she's the bruiser up the front going, all right, I'll draw their fire sort of thing and go from there. So,
two things I want to point out. In Wonder Woman, there's a scene in the alleyway where she sort of almost looks like she's catching bullets and things. Yeah. That's a throwback to the Christopher Reeve Superman movie.
Yeah, the
movie.
Richard Donner.
Except the roles are reversed.
Correct.
So instead of
instead
of the male Clark Kent catching the bullets, protecting the female, it's Wonder Woman protecting the male. So that was kind of cool. And I don't know. Now, Frank, you're the only one I haven't talked to about this, but it done my head in when I saw it because I saw it twice. When she's sitting there where the fountain and she's talking and she's having the beer, she's holding the beer, the big Steiner beer.
Yep.
She puts it. She makes a move and twists her waist and puts it down behind her.
Yep.
And keeps talking to Chris. Is it? Yeah, Chris.
Yeah. Chris. Steve Trevor.
And then it cuts to another angle of the shot, and she's holding the beer right in front of her face.
She puts it down again
a second time.
I didn't know.
So without any extended cut, that is gonna haunt me.
Once you see it, it can't be unseen.
Yeah. It's one of those.
Yeah. I didn't notice it the first. It's just
it's a continuity
cut.
Thing.
Yeah, it's just a slight cut. Issue.
Yeah. I'll have to keep
so I initially suspected there might be an extended cut right there where she maybe
that's her second beer
where she gets drunk and whatnot. It just a little. I don't notice many flaws in movie. That just from the first time I saw it, I couldn't unsee it.
You jumped
it.
Out,
did
yeah, you? Yeah, yeah. Cool. All right.
So something for our audience to look out for and shout out. Please if there's verify. Any other...
I've verified it.
People will be pausing the Blu-ray when it comes
out. It's quite noticeable. Yeah. I don't know if they make a clink sound both times, but... Yeah, yeah, definitely. She puts it down.
The fact she puts it behind her, there's no way really she could have grabbed it with the split second of the noose angle of the camera.
And it's the very next scene that it happens to.
Maybe the flash really quickly just like, oh, here you go. Drink as he's running.
No spoilers, Frank.
I said maybe, allegedly.
He was just too soon. I'm too soon.
Yeah.
I think there's a real power as well from the continuity now with having Wonder Woman in Batman versus Superman and establishing her own theme music. Because when she appears in that, there is a theme track that's also been in the trailers.
Seconds after leaving the theater, my wife had downloaded the ringtone. Yeah. She's like, that's my new alarm. And the next day, it went off, get it, and she's just up and she's ready for work in seconds. She's like, yes, this is so good.
But when that comes on in the film, it's really quite powerful. I mean, it's probably a powerful theme in its own
Doesn't happen until the last third, isn't it?
Yeah.
So even though you got that the no man's land scene in the middle of the movie, it's not till later on with the third act kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah, so really nice. I think it's a real plus for building out a broader universe to be able to do those things and really empower the moment.
Yeah.
So that's really good. All right. Beautiful. Thanks everyone for your views on Wonder Woman. So I think pretty much everyone's seen it twice here, which is a really good sign.
No, I haven't seen it twice, but we're going to. Yeah, we're going to take one of the nieces to go see it.
Very good. All right, we'll move on to our next segment, which is the toy line retrospective. So this is the segment where we basically look at some more obscure toy lines from the 80s and 90s and just have a little bit of a pitch or try and sell it to the other team members and see what you think. So I'll hand over to Ben, who's going to have a chat on...
Supernaturals. From Tonka, and they were released in 1987. So today we take holography for granted. Some of our hologram appears on nearly every driver's license and some form of our bank cards. But back in the day when holograms appeared on Tonka's Supernatural toy line, kids were fascinated. In place of a three-dimensional molded face and chest piece, each Supernatural's action figure mold was flattened with a holographic sticker affixed into the plastic of the toy. With a directive to release their hologram powers on the front of each toy package, where each character's hologram transformed from one image to the next. On both the figure and the figure's shield, Supernaturals were only produced for a single series, yet there was a good deal of product manufactured. Arguably the most popular of all Supernatural characters were the six large standard size action figures. Each come with one holographic shield accessory, a unique glow-in-the-dark weapon, and a short mini-comic explaining the Supernatural's backstory.
Mm.
Every large-scale Supernatural's figure possessed a removable chest piece that functioned to hide a great deal of the toy's hook. It's a two-phase hologram sticker, which would essentially function to make the figure's holographic innards a surprise feature. For consumers who wish to pick a less expensive toy, Tonka created a series of smaller scale figures, packed with the removable cloaks, a single glow-in-the-dark sword, and a Superpowers mini-comic. Their eight ghostlings were sold at a lower price point than the standard size figure. But the toy line didn't stop there. There were also beasts, vehicles, and a playset released as well. The two beasts were a dragon and a lion. They are very, very expensive in today's secondary market. Two monster trucks, vehicles, which in my opinion don't fit in the line at all. But who am I to disagree with the 80s? And last but certainly not least, the Tomb of Doom playset. It looks really, really cool and would act as a great centerpiece for any Supernaturals collection. These toys appeal to me as the hologram action figure is a very unique in my eyes, and I do love all things glow in the dark. I'm still hunting one figure from the larger scaled characters, Lionheart. So if anyone's out there, please send it my way. three of the smaller ghostlings, but I'm not really fussed about them as much as the Lionheart. Once I have them, I'm stopping. The beasts and monster trucks and playset, not only are they too large for my display area, but they are far too expensive in today's market. So
I think when you said Ghostlings and the small ones, I was like, oh, I'm pretty sure I had one of those. Yep. God knows where it is now. Yeah. But I still have floating around the actual mini comic. That's about all I've got left. Yep. And I was like, oh, I remember these guys.
Definitely.
I always got that line confused, though, with Visionaries.
Because
they're the same sort of thing. But just I think the Visionaries was all based around they had a staff, which was their holographic totem type.
So, Visionaries had a staff with the holographic totem. And then they on their chest, they had a holographic
avatar or like a beast or whatever was their power.
I think they're a bit shorter, more sort of between the G.I. Joe scale.
Yep.
And I've to this day never ever seen a Visionaries are like complete, never. Where I've seen Supernaturals time and time again. Yep. So it's just
cool.
Mm.
All right, Darren, did you want to do a pitch?
I will do a pitch. It'll be my very first action figure line, the Dukes of Hazzard toy line by Mego, and I'll be discussing the 3¼-inch line. They did a couple. So this is one that's in scale with, I guess, G.I. Joe and Star Wars figures, and I use those two parallels because there's 8 figures in this line. It's a single wave, 4 vehicles and a playset that didn't go past prototype. The interesting thing is that Bo and Luke, the primary characters, the Duke's boys, if you will, are articulated exactly like the G.I. Joe figures were or would be a few short years later, whereas the 6 more supporting characters are articulated in the way that the Kenner Star Wars figures were. So there is actually quite a bit of difference just in that one line. So as I said, there were 8 figures and 4 vehicles. Some of those vehicles were offered in gift sets, like the General Lee I received for my birthday. I had Bo and Luke with it in the box. You could also buy them on single cards, but they were released as a gift set with the generally, and Daisy was also released on the single card and also with her Jeep. Other vehicles included the Boss Hog Cadillac and the police car for Roscoe and Cletus. And what was cool about them, I guess, is, you know, obviously the Dukes of Hazzard was a property that I was growing up with back then. I really enjoyed it. I still do. Have a real soft spot for it, and it's historical for me because it was my very first action figure line. I still remember my birthday in 83 getting Bo and Luke with the General Lee from Mum and Dad, and also getting 5 of the 6 remaining characters. The only one I didn't get was Cletus. I got him later on, and it's really interesting because I did some research later on and found out that there was actually a Cooter's Garage prototype playset that was produced as a prototype but never hit market.
Very good. It was the articulation to do with getting them in the car.
I think that would have been the primary reason, although it does have a rooftop opening. But I reckon that probably was what it was meant to be. Mm. I'm not sure that there wasn't an earlier version of the General Lee that was put out, I think, from a different company that I know a lot of people were putting Bo and Luke in. I'm not too I'm pretty sure that was an earlier release, but obviously I was very young. And that, so I think that probably played a big role in the extra articulation. They do sort of stand out from the rest of the line.
Style,
because they're a different style. And I think that's another interesting footnote in that line's history, because not too many lines have such inconsistency.
That is unique for a toy line to be so different in their approach. That's why I was wondering if it was
was a big part of it. And like I said, you know, I can remember kids putting Bo and Luke in, you know, sliding them as they did in the show through the window of an earlier version of the General Lee because the roof didn't open, but the one that came in the gift set and was released separately, but I never saw it here separately. The one that was released in the gift set, you know, the roof opened up and it was made specifically for the toy line.
Mm.
Cool.
Very good. The toy line I was going to look at, and I've had a bit of a resurgence now in my collecting habits around looking at some of the old Kenner lines, and really tracing through the history of Kenner. And one of the lines I picked up recently, which I find fascinating, not only for the fact it's a toy line, but for the movie that went along with it, is Waterworld, which is the film that starred Kevin Costner, and probably started perhaps his demise as an actor and some of the roles he was taking on, and I guess the acclaim that they were getting, because he came off some really great films like Dances with Wolves,
yep, and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves,
and then took on a few.
Did he direct Waterworld as well, from memory?
Not sure. No, I don't think so, but okay. I'm not 100% sure. And it's fascinating. I think this line, I mean, it's a line of six basic figures, two deluxe figures, and one vehicle, which is the Trimaran, which is his signature sort of catamaran from the film, which is a really cool vehicle. It's got some beautiful box art. I think it actually features on the box art the other good guy from the line, which is the Atoll Enforcer, who never rides on the Trimaran with Kevin Costner, but he's there supporting him on the box art. But yeah, just, I guess, really fascinating to see. It's probably getting towards the end of Kenner before they were bought out by Hasbro. And really them trying to see what licenses they could acquire, what would be the next big hit, and really throwing their hand at a lot of different licenses that were popping up at the time. And obviously Waterworld was a box office failure, even though it made money, and probably wasn't something that was a successful toy line. Now, the line itself is sort of in that 5-inch, almost that Jurassic Park style. You've got three variants of Kevin Costner in different versions. They all sort of come with various accessories, including sea creatures, which are pretty cool. But three versions of Kevin Costner. You've got Nord, you've got Deacon, who's played by Dennis Hopper in the film, and the Atoll Enforcer. And then you've got two sort of deluxe vehicles, which is one of the smokers on their jet ski.
Yeah,
and then you've
got, I remember them.
Yep. And you've got Kevin Costner on sort of another sort of sea vehicle. And they're almost packaged. It's quite interesting because it's a figure on a vehicle, but they're still packaged on a regular sort of blister. It's just slightly bigger than the standard figures. And then you've got the Trimaran. So, look, the film, the toys probably aren't, you know, very valuable, but I think they're an interesting history in Kenner's life cycle, and they tell an interesting story about what Kenner was about, what Kenner was trying to do, and the sort of almost what you'd call a spattergun approach to acquiring licenses and seeing what might stick, and some did and some didn't.
You can see why they would. I'm just thinking out loud. I can remember the Robin Hood Prince of Thieves line was hugely popular when I was at school. And I can see why they might think that this could be the next big Kevin Costner.
It was huge as far as the hype for the movie.
And the toy line, you know, which I'm probably alluding to just as much as the film, I can see why Kenner might think, well, this could be the next Prince of Thieves line. And why they'd pursue it. And obviously, you got to get these things to market at a certain phase. So you do the license or pursue the license when you probably got no idea you certainly got no idea how the film's going to be received. You may not even have seen a script. You're probably just looking at sketches.
Kevin Costner's doing another movie. Count us in.
Exactly.
Well, it's Mad Max and water. How could you go wrong? It sounds awesome. I thought it was fantastic.
I like the film.
You know, but obviously with the budget and all the politics and things and the sinking of one of the vessels you don't film with kids, you don't film with animals, you don't film a whole movie on water.
Three strikes.
Yeah.
And if you do, you build toilets on the sets. Apparently they had no toilets on there.
Oh, wow.
So every so often they'd have to ferry basically all the cast off.
Wow.
That's where you cost.
I think at the time it broke the record for the biggest budget movie
$275 million it grossed over $360 million. So it still made money.
Yeah.
But
by the time you factor in marketing probably not a lot. It's an interesting one because Kenner, as you know, they were pursuing licenses. Movie licenses were doing well for them. I mean, obviously they had the Batman lines and Jurassic Park, as you said, and Star Wars. And Trent and I've had this conversation many times. Where did it go wrong? You've got Star Wars, Jurassic Park,
some big licenses,
and Batman, and
Alien Predator.
Alien Predator. And in that era, when you've got Batman under your control, Jurassic Park and Star Wars, you still go out of business or you get gobbled up by Hasbro.
Yeah, I
it's a fascinating.
This sounds like another podcast.
It is. Yeah. And I don't expect an answer. It's one of those things that's rhetorical. But you're right. It is a podcast topic, and it would be interesting to explore down the track, I reckon.
Yeah, there is some very good articles that have been written on this, entitled "The Kenner Legacy," which I think appear in various issues of Tamart's Action
Figure Guide.
And it's about a 16-parter over 16 sort of different issues of that, and I've only got some of the later years, but I'd love to get some of the earlier stuff. But it does start to talk about the demise, and you know, and doing a bit of research for this, the catch 22 that you spoke to, Darren, about, okay, well, you got to take a bit of a punt or take a bit of a bet on what the property might do for some of these, knowing that there could be the next hit on the line, or it could just tank like this one did. So there probably were a few of those instances where they missed the mark.
No way to know, yeah.
But the figures, you know, they're cool enough. They don't really do anything too spectacular. There's not a lot of action features to them. But they're pretty cool likenesses. It's that 1995, so you're starting to get, you know, you can tell that's Kevin Costner, and you can tell that's Dennis Hopper.
Cool.
So, yeah, pretty cool.
Very cool.
All right. At that point, we'll just head around the room and round out with any latest scores. So maybe, Ben, we'll start off with you.
So I was pretty fortunate to catch up with a lad from our local toy community who runs Oz Toys. And he hooked me up with a oversized Generation 1 Soundwave figure.
Oh, cool.
And it's considerably larger. It's on a blister card. it's got his missiles just next to his crutch sticking outwards. He's got like red eyes instead of yellow as the toy. He's got is on the blister card. It's got all this artwork, so it's got Ravage and Rumble and things. It's got versions of Generation 1 versions of Soundwave on the blister card, like from animation, Transformers animated and things. It's just there's so much wrong with it, but I freaking love it. The fact that it's oversized is just fantastic. I picked up a Master Universe coloring in book from him, and I also got Shredder from the NECA video exclusive video games. He got a whole set in, and he could understand I was going through some financial woes, and he cut Shredder off and said, "Here, you can have him if you're really, you know, because I
separated love from the set."
So that was just so cool. So massive thumbs up to Oz Toys for hooking me up.
Sweet.
And I managed to acquire some vintage Mint on Card Teenage Ninja Turtles figures from another mate from our SA toy collecting community. Those characters include the Toker and Raza from the Secret of the Ooze, Teenage Ninja Turtles Secret of the Ooze movie, the variant, the green Ray Fillet, and one of the April O'Neil variants, the one with the yellow and the purple, you know, the
purple 50, accessories. Fifth year
anniversary one. So really happy to get them, and I also got some resealed ones which I think are gonna make nice examples for loose that were, you know, very competitively priced.
Cool. I haven't really gotten anything new, but one of the things I have done is in setting up my toy room and stuff. I have a set of the vintage Ninja Turtle troll crossovers that they did circa sort of 1993, I think it was, or thereabouts. And my wife got those for me as a Christmas present a couple of years ago, and I've just said, "Oh, keep them in the box." And then I'm looking at my shelf of vintage that is all loose, and I just go, I feel silly keeping them in the box with everything else. It just doesn't gel. I've opened vintage stuff before, so I'm like, you know, so I've opened that, so they feel brand new to me, and all the, you know, they have the sword, like Leonardo has his sword, for example, really? But it's like made out of rock kind of thing. Like, it's a different mold, you know, because they're trolls. They mined it from, I don't know, whatever trolls get up to. But, yeah, I was kind of loath to initially because of the hair and stuff. It's actual proper rooted hair. But now I can, you know, put hairstyles on them and, you know, part Donnie's hair and mess up Mikey's hair and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, having some fun with that.
Yeah, nice.
Awesome.
I got the latest Dark Horse Masters of the Universe encyclopedia, which is done by Val Staples and James Entok, to name a few of the collaborators.
The thousand of them that worked on
it. There was a ton, and when you open it up, you can see why, and I think people were burning out because it's just so much that they wasted.
Daniel Galerta.
I don't have it in front of me, but yeah, I think they were all involved. There's quite a few involved. I think even Daniel Benedict might have had a part to play, but they're all credited in the book, so you can check it out. Some 698 pages of pretty much every detail from every iteration of He-Man, from the newspaper strips to the comics, even the movie. Darren was asking a question whether they were able to get to the movie, and there are elements from the movie. You know, I think it's about 4 pages on the power sword going through it, you know, all the different versions. There's different sections in the book. So, you know, I think... Yeah, if you're looking for beasts, they're in a different section potentially for vehicles and and factions and artifacts and everything. So, yeah, it's just such a rich and deep book, and I just can't wait to sort of go through it because it's going to take a while to sort of to sift through. But you can sort of treat it as an encyclopedia and look at the bits, I guess, you're interested in.
Yeah, we get that locally, or that was.
Yeah, you can get it locally, so you can check out. They've got it at Pulp Fiction Comics, so you can get it there. I actually ordered mine off. Book Depository. So it shipped and arrived the other day. But yeah, that's a beautiful one. And something I've also acquired from our mate who Darren grabbed the turtle stuff from was a complete Technodrome, which is just couldn't believe it. It's got the box. I'm a big fan of the boxed turtle, so it came with the box. So really happy to get that one. Technodrome story. Always wanted the Technodrome, but you know, it's popped up in some various iterations. I remember back in the day, it would have been late 90s, seeing it at the Salvos, one of those sort of Goodwill stores. And clearly it wouldn't have been complete.
Yep.
And going, I can't buy that. It's you know, it's a sort of a toy. And then going, really regretting it, and going back a couple of months later.
Why did I not?
Clearly, it was gone, and I've always regretted that because it probably would have been like $5 or something. Yeah, you know, really cheap.
Yeah,
but yeah, happy to have that now in the collection. Hopefully, with a bit of luck, I'll have the sewer playset arriving on Tuesday, so I can you know join the two up and finally get some of those playsets from Turtles. So really excited with that.
Awesome.
On that note, we will say goodbye, arrivederci,
sayonara,
see you next
and
time.
Good journey.
Yeah,
good journey.
And thanks for tuning in. Really appreciate it.
You can find the Toy Power team at all the usual online places: facebook.com/ToyPowerPodcast, at Toy Power Podcast on both Twitter and Instagram, or have your say and email us toypowerpodcast@gmail.com. Subscribe to the show on both iTunes and Stitcher. And please leave us a review. Otherwise, we just assume we're awesome.
Oh yeah, there's the power.